calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. The first day of 2006. Well, not the first day, the first business day. Well, it's actually not even the first business day. It's a federal holiday, isn't it? So anyhow, it's the first Monday of 2006, shall we say, yesterday. The beginning of the year. Here we are. Welcome. Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you on January 2nd, Monday, January 2nd of the new year. And we're going to be speaking with Robert Garmong in a moment. Then after that, I want to share with you some kind of a musical flashback to beginning of the year programs. And this is not exactly what you're expecting, so this will be interesting. And also, we're discovering here, those of you who are regular listeners or have been listening to the program for years know that in April, Louise and I moved out here to Portland, Oregon from Vermont, where we lived for 10 years. And we bought a house on the river, on the Willamette River, and it's now flooding. So our house is like 15 feet up. I mean, it's a floating house, right? We live on a you know, it's like on pontoons, and so we're not actually on the river. We're in the river, and have been all the time. And it's getting deeper and deeper and more interesting. The other day, a bunch of us in the community had to go out with a winch and pop part of the dock up because the dock was binding up on the pole that it rides up and down on, and starting to go off at a crazy angle. So. Fascinating, strange, you know, winds, weather, cold, heat, Gazprom, this thing that's going on in Russia, we'll be talking about that, what's going on with the former head of the KGB here, Mr. Vladimir Putin, and the Ukraine, and get into that as well. But first, Robert Garmong is with us. Robert is a specialist in political theory, ethics, and philosophy of law at the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And I think one of the reasons why it's important for us to visit periodically with the folks from the Ayn Rand Institute is that Ayn Rand's philosophy, now by and large called objectivism, of the virtue of selfishness, as it were, laid out in her book, a small book of a similar title, and the much larger book, Atlas Shrugged, and what are some of the other titles there, Robert?
Well, she wrote The Fountainhead, which was her other best-selling novel.
Yeah, The Fountainhead was the other big one. That basically what these books have laid out is a philosophy, a worldview, which is at the core of much of what is modern conservative, neoconservative, and Republican philosophy. And I realize that, Robert, you are none of the above and would disavow them because they're not sufficiently radical for you. Am I correct?
Well, I appreciate your taking note of that, and I think they would bristle at some of the things I would say. So, but I, nonetheless, I think you're right to say that Ayn Rand's ideas have been very influential on the so-called right or conservative movement.
Yeah. So looking at it from this point of view, Robert Garmong, what should America do? Last week in this program, I was going through a long list of companies, sector by sector by sector, that are being bought up inside the United States because we are buying so much junk from overseas and having to borrow money to pay for it that all these other countries are ending up with dollars, and they're like, you know, what do we do with this stuff? Well, let's buy America's industry. And so, first of all, we've got a lot of our industry has simply gotten up and moved. I mean, in some cases, entire factories have been dismantled and shipped to China. And in other cases, just, they started making shoes there, and the old shoe factories here are dead and gone. So we've got the outsourcing of America. But then the larger issue, what do we do, or maybe not the larger issue, but then the second issue, what do we do about foreign companies coming in and saying, well, we'll just buy up American companies left and right? You have a problem with that?
Well, as such, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with it. I think that free flow of capital has always been a good thing internationally. And if you look at those countries on the world scale that are most restrictive of foreign ownership of companies within their borders, those are countries like Mexico and much of the Third World that are among the poorest of countries. And those countries that have liberalized the flow of international capital are countries like India, and countries in the Southeast Pacific realm. And those are the countries that, as they've liberalized the flow of capital, have in fact had some of the greatest growth rates in history.
I think you might want to check your stats and your examples. I've done business in both Mexico and India, and it's fairly easy for an American company to set up in Mexico. It's fairly difficult for an American company to set up in India. And you can contract with an Indian company, and that's what a lot of American companies are doing, or they will partner with an Indian company. But India has, as does China, as does Japan to this day. In fact, I used to do business in Japan back in the, we had a strategic partnership with a Japanese company back in the late 1970s. And you could not, or at least I could not, as an American company, establish a Japanese corporation. I had to have a partner who owned 51% of the company who was a Japanese citizen.
That's right, and I would actually oppose most of those sorts of restrictions anyway.
So at what point do we cease being America if we simply say to the rest of the world, hey, anybody who wants can come in here and buy it? You know, and what happens when all of our businesses are owned by people outside the United States, companies outside the United States? You know, my publishing company, Random House, had published three of my books, of my books is owned by Bertelsmann in Germany. I mean, we have Chrysler is owned by a German company. The list goes on and on and on. And it's not so much, oh, gee, that's a nasty. I don't mean this as like some sort of a nationalist kind of macho thing, but the reality is that the reason why people go into business, and you know this well, Robert Garmong of AynRand.org, is to make a profit. And that profit presumably has some benefit to the society that's deriving it. And if all of the societies that are deriving the profits and taking the profits are outside the United States, aren't we basically being strip-mined?
No, I don't agree with that. And I think, first of all, it goes both ways. And, for instance, yes, Daimler owns a controlling share of Chrysler, but Ford owns controlling shares of many different automobile companies across the globe. And notice that Ford is the one that is hurting far less than GM, which has a similar corporate structure internally and within the United States, but isn't as well protected by international ownership.
Actually, GM is very aggressive in their internationalization. Opel was a major acquisition of theirs in Europe, and Opel cars are selling very well, for example. And increasingly what's happening now is that GM and other companies like them in the United States are saying, hey, we're just not going to be American companies anymore. We may have an American headquarters, but we're going where the business is.
Well, and I think that's absolutely the best thing for those companies.
But is it the best thing for America?
But the more important point is that I consider myself to be a liberal in the classical sense, and what matters is not...
Which would be called a conservative in today's United States. You're talking about the European use of the word liberal.
Well, I disavow the idea of conservatism for various reasons. I think that conservatism is a form of nationalism, so I don't...
Yeah, but I mean, I'm so as not to confuse our listeners, you know, if you and I are very different, you know, very on opposite ends of the pole here. You're talking about liberalism in the way that the Europeans use the word, which means no government control and corporations basically can do whatever they want.
That's right, within the bounds of the law, of course, and the law limited by individual rights. But my view is that it's a humanistic view, and it doesn't matter if Chrysler is owned by Americans or by Germans or by people from Mars, as long as rights are respected, that's the important thing. That as long as rights are respected...
So it doesn't matter where the profits go. If all the profits go to a handful of, in America, for example, if we end up with an oligarchy, if we end up with, like in Mexico, 36 families basically control the country, if we end up with 100 billionaire families in the United States and they basically own everything, or if all of the ownership of our American companies are offshore, that doesn't matter to you. That's just fine, as long as nobody's rights are being trampled, in your opinion.
Well, Tom, if you're concerned about it, then there's one very simple solution, and that is to invest your money in the Japanese stock market or the German stock market whichever international stock market you wish. You can become a multinational corporation if you so desire.
But then again, I'm sending American money outside the United States. I'm helping build infrastructure outside the United States.
And that, in turn, as you've just argued, is helping to build infrastructure here inside the states. So the free flow of capital across national borders is a good thing.
And so you're seeing a great leveling.
Can profit from it every bit as much as someone in Germany and Japan or Sumatra.
Okay. Robert Garamond, AYNRAND.org, the website. Robert, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's
good
always
talking with you.
Happy New Year.
Sure. Happy New Year to you, too, Robert. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour.
Working hard to make a living, bringing shelter from the rain. A father's son left to carry on blue denim.
Indeed, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity here on the Tom Hartman radio program. The point that Robert Garamond was making, not to put words in his mouth, I wouldn't presume to do that. But, in fact, even taking it out of what Robert was saying, here's the point that the Tom Friedman, the world is flat, a lot of folks who even think that Tom Friedman is a liberal of some kind or a progressive of some kind, which is bizarre to me, you know, with his book, The Olive Tree and the Lexus, which really was the cheerleading book for NAFTA, CAFTA, and the WTO, and helped bring all that stuff about. Now his book, The World is Flat, which was one of the five best-selling books of the year 2005, which is, in my mind, both mind-boggling and tragic. One of the big issues here, what these guys are suggesting is that there should be a great leveling. That nation states don't matter. That if labor is cheap in Mexico, then companies should be free to go to Mexico and get their labor there. And if there's wealth in the United States to buy those things, then we should be able to buy them. Now, on its face, at its surface, it sounds like a reasonable thing. I mean, why shouldn't a company be able to go wherever the labor is cheapest and sell products wherever they can get the best price? Makes sense. The problem is over the long term. It results in what's happening right now. In other words, this is the logic that was put forth when Reagan first started this stuff, started pushing for fast track, the right to negotiate these trade treaties outside of the traditional tariff system that we had in the United States that protected American industries. And then George Bush Sr. pushed for it really hard, and then Bill Clinton actually got the thing kicked through with NAFTA and, you know, GATS, the General Agreement on Treaties and Tariffs, and then later the General Agreement on Trades and Services, and leading to the creation of the World Trade Organization, and now CAFTA, it just pushed through. And what happens is that, yeah, you've got a lot of cash, a lot of disposable income in the United States. People can buy stuff. But the reason why we have a lot of disposable income in the United States is because, by and large, we have good jobs, because we've been protecting our domestic industries for over 200 years. So we have this legacy of wealth, of the remnant of a middle class left here in the United States as a result of 200 years of saying, over 200 years, of saying, you know, yes, we understand you can make steel anywhere in the world and make it cheaper than here. You can make shoes anywhere. You can make textiles anywhere in the world and make them cheaper than here. You can, you know, blah, 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 blah. But we're going to protect our domestic industries by putting in import tax tariffs on those things when they come into the United States. So you'll be discouraged from importing them from cheap labor countries, and instead you'll manufacture them here. In fact, the tariffs were so significant that they were the sole source of funding for the United States government at its creation. I mean, literally, from the administration of George Washington, the administration of Thomas Jefferson, the administration of James Madison, the administration of James Monroe, on and on and on, right up to the Civil War, tariffs were the sole source of income for the United States. and, you know, follow, and then and including in some cases tariffs on commerce between the states, taxes on things like whiskey and that sort of thing. And you know, there were some domestic taxes in there as well on consumption. And in fact, going into World War One, up until the 19-teens, tariffs were constituting something like 35 or 40% of the total revenue of the federal government. And so not only was this a source of wealth to run the government, not only was it a way to run the government, but it was also a way to define policy, to say, you know, okay, you know, business is free to operate and do business, but, you know, they're going to have to do it within certain parameters, within certain boundaries that are ultimately the best for this country. Now, people come along and say, well, why are you talking about this country all the time? Why are you talking about America all the time? What about those poor people in Mexico? What about the poor people in Nicaragua? What about the poor people in China? Shouldn't they have a shot at that? Shouldn't they be able to grab the brass ring? Sure. Sure, absolutely. Let them do it within their own country. Let them build their own domestic industries, too. And then let's trade in the things that we have decided we don't want or need to make here in the United States. I mean, we never had a debate in this country about whether or not we were going to make clothing in the United States any longer. We never had that debate. The discussion never happened. And it really should have. Because we've got all these textile mills that used to employ millions of people in the United States, and they're all shut down all up and down the East Coast. Well, it's really all over, all across the United States. Fabric, clothing mills, and it's all gone. We never had a debate where we said, you know, do we think it would be a good idea to continue making clothes in the United States? Do we think it would be a good idea to continue making computers in the United States? I mean, there might be some things where, A, it would be a good idea simply because we want to keep the jobs here. Or B, because, hey, you know, these things might actually be essential to our national security. I mean, isn't it ironic that the border security guards, the immigration and the INS border security guards, immigration and naturalization service guards at the Mexican border, on our side, our guys from the Department of Homeland Security, INS, are wearing uniforms made in Mexico. It's very strange. We'll get to your calls when we come back. I got to play a little bit of music for you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Here in the city, shrouded in smoke. 10 million people this morning awoke to a future of cancer, industrial disease. So let's build some more suburbs and buy SUVs. Cut down the mountains, burn all the coal, and put all the money in a humongous bowl. They'll call it progress and they'll blame it on you to end life as we know it, to enrich the few. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. That's 440-THOM. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, will get you there. And click the live chat link, and it'll get you into our live chat room. Where Ben Birch, who's running our stream on White Rose Society, gave me a news flash here. West Virginia explosion traps 13 miners. This just moments ago. A county emergency official says an underground explosion at a West Virginia coal mine has trapped 13 miners in Upshur County, West Virginia. It happened at 8 a.m. Eastern Time in the Seago, S-E-A-G-O, mine in West Virginia. There were 19 guys underground. Six of them made it up. 13 are trapped more than a mile underground. And when rescuers tried to get to them, they literally came to a wall. So they're trying to figure out what to do next. Expect to see this dominating TV news as soon as they can get their TV cameras down there. And once again reminding us that when George W. Bush, was it last week or the week before last, when he was giving his speech on immigration, and he said, we need to bring these immigrants in to do the jobs that Americans won't do. Let it once again remind us that there is no job an American won't do. for a decent paycheck. What Bush really meant is we need to bring illegal immigrants and make them legal in to do the jobs that Americans won't do unless they're well paid. I mean, I remember the old honeymooners program from 57 to 59. Jackie Gleason and Art Carney. And Jackie Gleason played the character of Ralph Cramden. He drove a bus in New York City. They lived in a fourth-floor walk-up, a cold water walk-up in New York City. And Art Carney was his character. I'm forgetting his name. Lily White was his middle name, I remember. In any case, his character worked in the sewers. But he had a pension. He had a good union job. And, you know, they could get by. So but I digress. Anyhow, we're talking about these things. The one thing I wanted to share with you, just because it's the first day of the new year, this is our kind of new year. One of the kind of New Year standards back in the late 30s and the early 40s, one of the New Year standards was never say never again. And never say never again was written by, who was it? Alexander had that. You know, remember, Louise? No, it was Harry Woods. That's right. There we go. And Dan Jacobs tracked it down for us. And so this was, you know, along with Auld Lang Syne, you know, throughout the 30s. I mean, the people would go and they'd dance, and this was like one of the big dance songs in the late 30s and early 40s. And as the war propaganda was ramping up, after World War II had started and before the United States had entered the war, so this must have been like, you know, 40, 41, something like that. This is a song. This is the actual German propaganda version that was played out of Germany and broadcast into England as England was being bombed by the Germans. And I think you'll find it fascinating because, first of all, it's the song, and then there's the propaganda. And it's fascinating. Plus, you know, as I said, this was a New Year's standard. This was, you know, from the winter of whichever year that was. I haven't been able to determine the year. I just have this, an archive of old German propaganda music. Never Say Never Again song. Your grandparents will remember this well.
I'll never say never again, 'cause here I am in love again, head over heels in love again with you. I'll never say never kiss you again, 'cause here I am kissing you again, that's just the thing I say I'd never do. I walked away and said goodbye. I was hasty, wasn't I? I missed you so I thought I'd die. But it's all over now, throw my head in the sky. I'll never say never again, 'cause here I am in love again.
Okay, that's the Harry Woods version of the song. Now listen. It's going to start sounding like George W. Bush.
Here is a new version sent to us by a disillusioned Englishman. We'll never say never again. Cause here we are at war again. Up to our necks in war again with you. We'll never say never fight wars again. Cause here we are at war again. It's just the thing that Churchill made us do.
Yeah, Churchill made us do it, you know.
We thought to war we'd say goodbye. Cause war ain't fun and that's no lie. We like to live and we hate to die. But it's all up now and that too is no lie. We'll never say never again. Cause here we are at war again. Up to our necks in war again. And we can't pull through.
Yes. And now here we discovered today in the newspaper, George W. Bush has been paying not only journalists in Iraq for favorable coverage, for, you know, this kind of propaganda. Saddam Hussein, he made us do it, just like the Germans were saying. Roosevelt made us, not Roosevelt, Churchill made us do it. Now we're not just funding the newspapers, we're also funding Sunni clerics. I mean, it just gets weirder and weirder and weirder. So anyhow, Happy New Year to you. We live in strange times, my friends. We live in absolutely strange times. And it's like, What goes around absolutely comes around all over again. Indeed. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Will in Brea, California. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Truth Teller.
How you doing, Will?
Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
I just wanted to point out that if you work a little bit to it, a little bit of work, you can find American companies that actually sponsor paying people well and doing the right thing, like Costco and Freedom Underwear, an apparel company that sells only sweatshop-free products. Oh, it's mine. But it's a Freedom Underwear Company.
Okay, and how can people find that on the web?
FUCO, FUWCompany.com.
Okay, great. FUWCO.com. Will, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for that.
Have a great one, Truth Teller.
You too, Will. I know also there are union-made jeans out there. If you Google for this stuff, you can find it. But it's again, it's not the norm, tragically. Harlan in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Harlan, welcome.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
Yeah, listen, I agree with what you're saying regarding globalization and that we're better off. But I think that, you know, in looking at Tom Friedman's text or his book, I think his point that he was trying to make was that globalization to a certain extent is inevitable because of the information age, and that I think his point was that we need to become better able and to deal with what inevitably is going to come, and that there's going to be difficulties along the way, but that ultimately we're going to be better off. Now,
except that he doesn't specify how or why. Essentially, basically, he says, you know, well, we've got to educate ourselves better. Well, anybody can educate themselves better. Any country can educate themselves better. I mean, he's doing a massive blaming the victim. If you go back and read The Olive Tree and the Lexus that he wrote 20 years ago, 15 years ago, he was saying the exact same thing about outsourcing of manufacturing technology. That, you know, well, we've got these laws that are doing away with tariffs, it'll be a fine thing that we'll be making cars in China and all that kind of stuff, and I just don't buy it. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, my problem that I have is let's assume that he's correct. If he's correct, then we need to have a much better educational system. The GOP is that essentially that, you know, they're promoting globalization without at the same time financing education. They choose to finance a war in Iraq as opposed
to
financing education.
I agree with you, Harlan, but still, Tom Friedman is not correct because education is not the solution.
Let me address one thing, and it's funny because I heard you just say that, you know, Americans won't do these jobs, and I've been saying for a long time that Americans won't do these jobs at this price.
Right.
And I have every confidence that Americans will almost do anything for money. I expressed this to a friend of mine who worked at the World Bank that essentially – I mean, excuse me, at the Federal Reserve Bank, that if you paid an American $20, they'd pick oranges. There's no doubt in my mind. His response to me was, well, that's fine, but then oranges will be this much per pound. You'll get undercut by Mexican oranges.
Yeah, assuming that you're importing Mexican oranges.
Right,
If you're paying a decent wage, then you've got a whole bunch of people who are making $20 an hour who can afford to easily buy oranges.
Well, hence we have essentially a bipartisan sort of wink when they not dealing with the illegal labor issue, because
right.
In essence and I joke about this, but I think it's both a liberal and a conservative issue, because they're conservatives who basically, you know, just be playing the hard line, don't like illegal labor, but it really hurts the liberal part of American the body.
Oh, the whole point of illegal labor here, Harlan, is to increase the supply of labor to drive down the price of labor.
So
it's all about union busting and cheap labor.
I think this is one of the issues, together with like universal health care, that the majority of Americans share in common.
Yeah.
Why isn't it a political issue? Why aren't the parties dealing with it?
Because the big corporations are profiting from it tremendously, and they're writing checks to virtually all of the Republican Party and a goodly chunk of the Democratic Party, and that's the tragedy. That's why progressives need to take back the Democratic Party. It's why progressives need to be stepping forward and saying enough already. You know, from illegal immigration right across to, you know, so-called globalization. We need to clean this act up. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hart.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends, to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, 9 minutes before the hour. Sam in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Sam, welcome to our program.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say I really love your show. I'm a big fan.
Thank you. And thanks for listening on WPTT there in Pittsburgh.
Betcha. Well, I had what prompted me to call you was I heard you started to talk about, I believe his name's Tom Friedman.
Yeah.
His book, The World is Flat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had read a couple excerpts from that on the internet, and I also heard Tom Friedman on that show, that was St. Paul's, or no, what's it called? I forget. It's a
whatever it was, yeah. Yeah.
I agree. Commonwealth Club.
Mm-hmm.
Commonwealth Club. And he talked extensively about the book. And, you know, I think the emphasis of the book and for, you know, Tom Friedman's ideas are really, the word here is shock and awe. He is just in shock and in awe of what capital can do, and he's just thrown up the white flag. He's just, these guys, what they do is amazing, and they do it so fast, and it's happening so lightning fast. There's nothing we can do about it. So
or he's decided that if his bread gets buttered on that side, he can do fairly well. I mean, he sold over 1 million books this year.
Well, yeah.
That's not too shabby.
But I think, you know, for him, he's just, he doesn't even see another vision of what people can do. This is just so powerful in his eyes
that
there's really no point in fighting it.
Yeah, and that's the tragedy. And the bigger tragedy is that so many people in Congress, in particular, are buying into this. I mean, this is basically the vision of American industry, which is let's level the world. Okay, there's 6 billion people in the world. Half of them live on less than $2 a day, right?
Yeah.
So if you really are going to have a flat world, that means our standard of living is going to be, maybe if we're lucky, a paycheck of somewhere around $40 or $50 a week, which is big money in a lot of the world.
Out to everybody else. That's right.
That's right. That's right. $40 or $50 a week is huge money to the rest of the world. And so if we're going to flatten out the world, if we're going to do what Tom Friedman suggests, you know, that's the future of America. And I'm sorry, that's not the future of the American that I want to leave for my children and grandchildren.
Neither. And I think, you know, what he asserts in the book isn't new. I mean, there's other people that have asserted this stuff.
They've been saying it for 200 years. Alexander Hamilton was the first to promote this kind of stuff back in the 1790s, you know, when he was Secretary of the Treasury. He was promoting this kind of vision.
What discourages me is just I don't really, in the mainstream, there is not an alternative to this. This is the religion of America right now.
Well, I think there is a strong backlash forming, and they are being, by and large, marginalized and dismissed as populists. And oddly enough, much of it seems to be coming from the right, from Republicans like Lou Dobbs and populists like Pat Buchanan. But I got to tell you, this is not a left-right issue. This is not a liberal or conservative issue. This is, do you stand up for America or do you stand up for multinational corporations, period? I mean, there is a new entity out there that is running over the world. William Grider first identified this 15 years ago in his book, One World Ready or Not. And he did a brilliant job of it, that there's this giant reaping machine moving across the world and nobody's in charge of it. It just eats everything in its path and spits out waste and spits out, you know, wealth to a certain small number of people. Sam, thanks for the call. I appreciate the point. Well made and well said. 1-866-440-8466, our number. Jeffrey in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jeffrey, what's on your mind?
Actually, it's Jerry, Tom. Happy New Year.
Thank you, Jeffrey, and the same to you. Jerry, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. The Tom Friedman thing, it just, he and a number of the neocon spokesmen like Grover Norquist and that sort of thing seem to be trying to put out this information that globalization is like the rain.
It's an unstoppable force. Just throw up your hands and give in to it.
Exactly. Instead of saying that all political and economic models are recreatable and better models can be brought about. And the idea being to discourage the people from pursuing a political resolution to this and putting up some kind of resistance to it.
Right. And what really amazes me, frankly, is, yeah, I remember back in the 50s and 60s where you had the John Birch Society and you had a good chunk of the Republican Party, actually, and even a lot of the Democratic Party, the conservatives in the Democratic Party, like Lyndon Johnson, who were, you know, running around freaking early Lyndon Johnson, not post-presidential Lyndon. He actually became a liberal later in his years. But you know, the early on, the Southern Democrats, who were just hysterical about the United Nations and talking about, you know, all these threats to America. America and communism and all this stuff, and they want to destroy our way of life, and we you know, it's got to be America first and America for Americans, and Sam Walton, you know, his Buy America First, you know, program and all that stuff. And all of a sudden, you know, ever since Tom Friedman's Lexus Tree and the Olive, and I didn't mean to turn this show into bashing Tom Friedman. I mean, you know, I'm sure he's a very decent guy. But, you know, all of this stuff has kind of gone by the wayside since this religion that I'd say he's more a symptom of than a cause of let's just let the multinational corporations do whatever's best for the multinational corporations, and it'll eventually trickle down on all of us. And, you know, you know, guess what? We are creating a nation, you know, trickle-down economics is creating a nation of peons.
Yeah.
And we are all being peed on. I mean, this is the trickle-down economics. Here you go.
And that objectivism perspective, to my way of thinking, shares a view with being a deadbeat dad. It's this idea of, well, if I could kick loose some of my responsibilities, how much better could I be?
There you go. There you go.
Saying, I'm getting something out of this.
That's right. And that's exactly what United and General Motors and all these other companies are doing with their pensions and things. Jerry, thanks for the call. Doreen in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Doreen, what's up?
Hi, I was just calling because I was thinking I'm actually writing another letter about David Horsey had a question about what have baby boomers contributed and compared to our generation now. And you look back, the greatest generation went to war, they paid for the war, they taxed themselves, they, you know, came home, they saved their money, they put themselves to school and their kids to school. Now we've gone to this egocentric baby generation. I want it now, and I don't want to pay for it.
Well, I don't think that you can characterize an entire generation like that because Bill Clinton flipped that around. I mean, you know, he actually balanced the budget. I would say that what you're describing is the infantilism, and thank you for your call. We're out of time here. The infantilism that you're describing is characteristic of George W. Bush and the Republicans and some of the Democrats in power. Yes, we will borrow from our children and our grandchildren so that we can make it look like we have a good economy, so that we can maintain power, so that we can turn more of America over to multinational corporations. And frankly, I don't think it's the best thing for this country. At all. At all!
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. Diane Farsetta is with us with PRWatch.org. PRWatch has a new award in their No Fake News campaign. Hey, Diane, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, pleased to have you here. Tell us about the Falsies Awards.
They are the Falsies Awards, and it's actually our second annual Falsies Awards that we'll be bestowing. And as you said, they'll be on the website prwatch.org later on today. But basically what we did is the year was winding down. You know, several of us here at the center sort of brainstormed up a list of about 20 major spins over the past year. And what we did is we went out to our readers and we said, you know, could you please vote? It's hard for us. there have been so many spins in the news last year, from the, you know, the fake news that the Pentagon was placing in the Iraqi newspapers to the video news releases here in the U.S., all sorts of, you know, pundit payola going on. So we went to our readers and we said, could you please help us narrow these down for our Falsies Awards? And we got a... Mm-hmm.
No, I said, yeah, I was agreeing with you.
Okay. So, yeah, and we had about 850 people that went online and filled out our survey and helped us whittle that down to five main winners. And then we also have a Falsies Reader's Choice Award.
That's great. Can you tell us who the winners are?
Sure. Well, at the top of the list, the Gold Falsies Award winner for last year was the video news release industry, and we also give a nod to their accomplices in television newsrooms. And what these the video news releases are, VNRs, folks might remember, back in March, the New York Times looked at government-funded VNRs and found that there are at least 20 different government departments that are putting out these video segments that are produced by PR firms or PR people within government agencies. agencies to look exactly like television news reports. And the problem is, are often aired by the television news programs without any disclosure to the viewers to say, look, this report on the Agriculture Department was actually funded and produced and scripted by the Agriculture Department, and therefore, you know, it might not tell you everything that you might want to know.
Right.
So we wanted to definitely shine the light on them again, and also to point out that the vast majority of video news releases come from private sources. It comes from companies much more often than it does come from government sources. So that's the Gold Award winner.
Oh, now, I'm curious, before you continue with the rest of the award winners,
mm-hmm.
I remember probably the most famous of the fake news reporters was that poor woman who was actually, actually once had a career in TV, you know, mm-hmm. broadcasting. I'm missing her name, though.
It's Karen Ryan.
Karen Ryan. There you go.
And everyone's favorite reporter. Yes.
There you go. Karen Ryan. And I'm wondering, is there a physical Falsey Award? And if so, what does it look like?
Well, what we have on our website, or what we will have later on today, is sort of the Groucho Marx, the glasses where you have the fake nose and the shaggy eyebrows and the mustache, and that's our visual representation. There's not so much a physical Falsies Awards, but what we are tongue-in-cheek saying that we will give to Falsies Awards winners is a one-way ticket to Spinsville, which is a magical land where global warming doesn't exist, corporations exactingly police themselves, and the number of violent terrorist attacks around the world is decreasing. That is our...
Because I'm sure that, you know, this is not lost on you, that for most people they hear falsies and they think either stuffed bras or guys with socks in their pants.
Yes. And, well, it started off as being a very tongue-in-cheek thing, and we weren't sure if we wanted to stick with that, but we decided to
have fun. It's worked out
with
well.
It.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
So, but you're using the Groucho. That's a fine ball. Okay, so number two winner.
Yes, the Silver Falsies Award, and this goes to mainstream media and the Bush administration, they're sharing it, for not counting the dead. And this is both the dead Iraqi civilians and also people in Afghanistan who have been killed by the U.S. invasions of those countries. And this was, we thought, a very underreported story. Again, back in March of 2005, American University's School of Communications did a survey of 200 U.S. media personnel and found that, you know, according to themselves, they said that they censored their own reports on Iraq because they were afraid of offending their audience. So we felt that coupled with the late October 2004 report from The Lancet, you know, a very meticulous report of on-the-ground reporting where they estimated some 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died since the U.S. invasion, and that got little to no coverage mm-hmm. in mainstream media. And more recently, this October, the Pentagon said, and this was to prove that, you know, the war on terror in Iraq is actually having some effect, they started periodically releasing enemy body counts. You know, and there are a lot of questions about where these numbers come from, what do they really mean. We felt it was very much a PR tactic, you know, to try and boost some flagging support here for the Iraq war. And then just a few weeks ago, President Bush said that he thought, you know, somewhere around 30,000 Iraqis more or less have died as a result of the U.S. invasion. And this was, again, a very scripted moment of candor, you know, to prove that he had some hold on reality, but was really using the lowest number that he possibly could to give some indication that he was aware that war had any sort of, you know, negative repercussions.
Now, I'm curious, Diane Farsetta with PRWatch.org, one of the, since we're talking about body counts and deaths and death numbers and the spin around them, one of the persistent questions that's been out there over the last couple of years is how the U.S. is actually determining U.S. casualties. Mm-hmm. There was some concern for some time that the U.S. was saying, okay, if you die in Iraq or on your way out of Iraq, clearly, then it's considered a casualty. But if you get to the hospital in Germany, or if you get to the Walter Reed and you die, then it's not considered an Iraqi casualty. And that, you know, whether or not suicides were included in that, and all these, I mean, there's a whole bunch of questions. There's entire groups out there trying to get actual death numbers, and it seems very hard to get, you know, get a hold of. some folks suggesting that instead of 2,000 casualties, we might actually have 5, 6, 8, 10, 12,000, something like that. Any take on that? Any information on that?
Well, I think that that's a really important point. And, you know, I would also add to the numbers that are not in the U.S. numbers, the private military contractors, which there's a huge amount in Iraq. Those aren't counted.
Yeah, that's the second largest army. 20,000 people. Pardon my interrupting you.
Right. Oh, no. But, yeah, so there are so many numbers. You know, and again, with the wounded, it's my understanding that if people come back, for example, with, you know, concerned about exposure to depleted uranium or with, you know, the more post-traumatic stress, then that's not counted as part of the wounded. So there are, you're completely correct, there are so many questions around the numbers, the real cost of the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
Okay, so that's number two. We've got about 2 minutes left to wrap up the final three here.
We'll do a quick, yes, the Bronze Falsies Award goes to the U.S. military and the public relations contractors, and this is for spinning wars and psychological operations. And that I mentioned at the top, the Pentagon planting the stories in Iraqi newspapers, that's in with that. You know, this whole increased outsourcing of this very particular, very sensitive military, you know, and questionable military operations called psychological operations. That's in there. We have dishonorable mentions that went to President Bush and what we're calling support our props, which is when he had the video conference that was billed as a back and forth with the troops, was actually scripted and rehearsed beforehand by public relations people. And the last in the...
Now, if I may, Diane.
Sure.
That one we knew about because we actually caught the video of the woman who was doing the rehearsal. To what extent do you think all of them have been that way?
And that's right, and that's another great point. Actually, Sheldon Rampton, who's the senior researcher, or research director, I should say, here at the center, he wrote a piece about that, again, that's at prwatch.org, where he said, you know, really, that this is, you know, the example or the exception to the rule that points out how the media is just, you know, every day the media is being massaged by the Bush administration. And for the most part, they go along with it.
Yeah. Okay, and the final one.
The final one is Representative Tom DeLay, and that is for his mugshot mug. So, and that's, of course, people know back in October when he reported for the to the Harris County, Texas Sheriff's Office for his fingerprinting and mugshot for the campaign finance conspiracy and money laundering. You know, he looked so happy, and, you know, the usual booking information wasn't on the mugshot. It was basically they wanted to make sure that that shot wouldn't be used against him.
Well, that was pretty smart of him, actually. You know, I wonder if there's going to be a whole new thing now where when people get arrested, they smile and they look really, you know, I God forbid if I ever got picked up for anything. I think I'd take Tom DeLay's example. You know?
That's right. Why not look marvelous?
There you go. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, under all circumstances. Diane Farsetta with PRWatch.org. PRWATCH.org. Thanks so much for being with us, Diane.
Yeah, thank you.
And congratulations on a great job. The great job you've done this last year. And may this year be even better. Thanks for being with us. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
He took all the trees and put them in a tree museum. And charged the people a dollar and a half to see them. No, 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 don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone. You'd be a paradise and put up a fucking lie.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. A program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics. 1-800-511-MAX. 511-MACS. SmallDog.com, their website. Welcome back to our program. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is with us. TalkRadioNews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Very happy New Year to you and to everybody on the show.
And a happy New Year to you, too. Yesterday, I started, on two different occasions, I started to call Ellen, and in both, you don't want to hear the whole story about the fact that we're living on a river that's being flooded right now. But in any case, both times I got derailed. How is she?
She is recovering, and she's hoping to talk with you at least once this week. She's taking things very slowly this time. And you know, it's one of those things. It's going to take time because it has to heal, and we have to make sure that the retina doesn't detach again.
She has vision in her eye again?
I don't know. When I spoke with her this morning, we actually didn't talk about whether she has vision yet.
Okay. All right. Well, I did, again, please give her our very best.
Absolutely.
So what's going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, I mean, basically nothing because no one's here, and those who are talking about the Redskins, but that apart, it has to be the spying story. It has to be President Bush once again defending his spying, NSA spying program. A story that they tried to deflect by making the story about the hearings about the investigation by the Justice Department. But every time the president defends the program, the story comes back to being about the actual story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that really is causing a lot of consternation in Congress who feel that they're just not treated as an equal branch of government.
I find it very interesting that when Woodward and Bernstein broke their deep throat revelations about crimes in the White House, that there was not a Justice Department investigation of Woodward and Bernstein. And now we have the New York Times breaking a story about crimes in the White House, and the response, and nobody's pointing this out, the weirdness of this, how times have changed in the last 30 years. The response is not, let's see if there's actually a crime going on in the White House. The response is, let's investigate the New York Times.
Exactly. That is the response. And
I mean, can you imagine if Nixon had called for the Justice Department to investigate Woodward and Bernstein?
And in a way, it's kind of surprising that he didn't, when you come to think about it. It is amazing. I think one of the differences that people would cite is that there's national security involved because we're, quote, a war, unquote.
Well, we were in the middle of the Vietnam War at that time.
Correct.
I mean, it was Gerry Ford who, as I recall, who presided over the very end of the war, wasn't it? Wasn't Gerry Ford in office when
the
very last guys came off the roof of the embassy in Saigon? So, in fact, we were, you could argue, in a much larger war at that time. I mean, there were 50-some thousand Americans, nearly 50,000 dead at that by that time, 40-something certainly by that time, and hundreds of thousands of American forces in Vietnam. My take on it is that back then, if Nixon had said, "What? The Washington Post is investigating me? We're gonna nail those guys," that there would have been a hue and cry in America, because back then people understood that news, that Edward R. Murrow thing. I'm assuming you've seen the movie Goodbye and Good Night and Good Luck.
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, you've got to see it.
I can't wait.
But Americans got it. The news is like this sacred thing. It's called the Fourth Estate. It's like the fourth branch of government, and its job is to keep government in check. That's its purpose. That's why it is the only industry of all the various thousands of industries that the founders could have selected. I mean, they could have easily, you would think, selected, for example, the armaments industry and carved out a place for them in the Constitution. But no, they didn't. The only industry, the only private business that the founders and framers of the founders of this country and the framers of the Constitution saw fit to put into the Constitution itself in the First Amendment was the press. And the reason why was because it is the Fourth Estate. It is the fourth branch of government. Its job is oversight of government. And back during the Nixon era, everybody in America understood that. And ever since the late 80s, when Reagan took apart the obligation of radio and television stations to actually play real news in order to maintain their licenses, which meant that the networks no longer had to provide real news and they could move to infotainment, and we've gone to infotainment ever since that time. It's like, oh, the press, they're like, public opinion polls, they rank down there with politicians now.
Yeah, the press is considered an annoyance. And until something like Katrina happens and everybody wants the press, but the press is an annoyance and the press shouldn't be doing its job. I think you're absolutely right. I think that is, to a certain extent, public opinion.
I think we need to re-educate America about the importance of the press in the United States. And the only way, frankly, I think that we're going to do it, Victoria Jones, is if the press starts doing its job, its traditional fourth estate job.
And continues to do its job and doesn't turn on each other when the job's done.
And in that regard, I have to congratulate you, because you are consistently there in that White House briefing room, giving hell to Scotty and the whole bunch. And I and
You do such a great job there at the Talk Radio News Service.
Thank you very much.
All of you. All
Thank
of you.
I will let everybody know. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah, give our very best to Greg and to Ellen, and may this year be the best so far, and we'll talk to you again as the week goes on.
Okay, will do.
Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. It's 27 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program. You're in the middle of the real free speech zone. No barbed wire fences. We won't drag you away if you've got a No Blood for Oil bumper sticker.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love, no one really cares. There's Nazis in the bathroom, just below the stairs. Always something happening, nothing going on. There's always something cooking, nothing in the pot. They're starving back in China, so finish what you got.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up on 25 minutes before the hour. The crisis in between Russia and, ostensibly between Russia and the Ukraine, although really it's become a crisis between Russia and Europe, has ended for the moment. But this is really interesting. This is you get into the politics of this region, and you get it that there are like layers within layers within layers of political stuff going on here. You will remember, first of all, just to back up a little bit, that in Serbia, long ago and far away, there was an election, and there was this group of five or six guys, young men, who came up with the idea of, why don't we market an election in a particular way? They came up with a logo. They came up, as I recall, the logo in Serbia was the ticking clock was the one they used in the Ukraine, as I recall. But in any case, they came up with a logo. They came up with a slogan. They came up with a color. They got the Organization for Cooperation and Unity in Europe, or whatever it's called, and the UN to monitor, to do exit polls of the elections, because they expected the government to steal the election, basically. And when the exit polls showed that the pro-democracy candidate had won by a slim margin, by just a couple of points, they literally hit the streets with that information within minutes before the official government agencies and the official government news agencies were able to say that the former president was still the president, that the president had been reelected. And they were able to flip the election in Serbia. And so the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and a group called Freedom House, which was founded by Eleanor Roosevelt here in the United States, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, which some people over the years have suggested is, you know, part of a CIA program, but that, be that as it may, the U.S. State Department, it's part of the State Department, got together and hired these guys and said, let's do this some more times. And they tried it in Belarus, and they failed, former Soviet Republic. They tried it in Soviet Georgia, they succeeded, and they tried it in the Ukraine, and they succeeded. And in the Ukraine, you'll recall, remember the Orange Revolution? They had an election. And at the end of the vote, the government said, hey, you know, the guy aligned with Russia, who was not particularly democratic, he was more of an autocrat, he won. He won by 4 or 5 points, but the exit polls showed that he lost by 4 or 5 points. It's actually kind of similar to the 2004 election here in the United States, where the official vote total showed that George W. Bush won by 3 million votes, but the exit polls showed that he lost by 5 million votes. So what happened was that in the Ukraine, the folks hit the streets before the government had a chance to get its story out, saying, hey, you know, Yushchenko, the good guy, the pro-democracy guy, the pro-Western guy, he won. And the Orange Revolution and everybody wearing orange scarves and the whole bit, and they had spray painted these logos all, you know, on sidewalks all over the place, and the slogan, you know, his time is up, and the ticking clock, and all this stuff. Well, this did not win any points with Vladimir Putin, whose hand-picked candidate was the guy who Yushchenko was running against. and so Viktor Yushchenko, and so and who, by the way, will be running against Yushchenko again in March. Now is it starting to make sense that there may be some tension between Russia and the Ukraine? There's going to be another election in March. And so Russia says to the Ukraine, you know, back when you guys were like, you know, run by one of Putin's good buddies, Putin's saying to them, you know, run by one of my good buddies, we cut a deal to sell you natural gas at $50 per 1,000 cubic meters. $50 per kilo cubic meter, whatever you call it. So, you're not our friends anymore, so we're going to raise the price to $230, which is really more in keeping with the world price. And we're going to raise the price overnight in January, which will, of course, throw the Ukrainian economy into a tailspin, which will, of course, put a lot of people out of work, which will, of course, make Yushchenko look very bad and probably not help him get reelected, shall we say. And so Yushchenko says, hey, wait a minute, you're trying to mess with our politics here. This is a political thing that you're doing. Now, the gas, 25% of all the gas for the rest of Europe, you know, Germany, France, you know, on and on, goes through the Ukraine on its way from Russia to, you know, into Poland and then into Germany and into the rest of Europe through these gas lines. And as soon as the Soviets cut off the gas to the Ukraine, all of a sudden there was a 30% drop in gas going into the rest of Europe. And then Russia's saying, hey, we didn't cut the gas going through the pipeline that goes to Europe. The Ukrainians are stealing that gas. And the Europeans are saying, we don't care. You just cut our gas. And so the German foreign minister steps in, the economy minister, excuse me, Michael Glaus. Germany is the biggest customer for Germany's gas. They buy about 25% of all of the gas of Russia's gas, and about a quarter of all the gas that Russia is importing into Europe, about a quarter of it is bought by Germany. And so he says, you guys have to, you know, we're not going to trust you as a supplier. We're going to start looking for other supplies if you guys don't get your act together. And Washington steps in. State Department spokesman Sean McCormick says yesterday, he says, such an abrupt step creates insecurity in the energy sector in the region and raises serious questions about the use of energy to exert political pressure. And see, that's what it's all about. This is Putin doing payback to Yushchenko, saying, you know, yeah, maybe we tried to steal that election, or maybe we didn't. I mean, you know, the Russians are still saying, and Yushchenko's enemy, I'm forgetting his name, the guy who he ran against, is saying, we didn't steal the election. You know, you guys had another election, and yeah, you won the second election because you made it look like we stole the first election, and we lost popularity, and there was this whole popular wave of, you know. I mean, can you imagine what would have happened in the United States if the night of the election in 2004, November 5th, 2004, thousands of people had gone in the streets saying, hey, the exit polls show that George Bush lost by 5 million votes, John Kerry won by 5 million votes. Congratulations, John Kerry's president. And then the next day, the government came out and said, no, ignore those exit polls. Our official tabulation shows that George Bush won by 3 million votes. Now, that's actually what happened, except that the government got out ahead of the people in the United States. I was doing news reporting at WDEV, one of our affiliate radio stations in Vermont. I lived in Montpelier at the time. And that night, and I remember around 10:30 or so, 10:30 thereabouts, the AP story came down. George Bush had just been sat down by Karen Hughes, who told him that the exit polls showed that he'd lost the election. And he seemed unconcerned. And I remember thinking, that's a strange response. And then a half hour later, boom, all of a sudden, Bush is president. So anyhow, that, you know, the parallels here between the United States and the Ukraine. So The Ukraine says, you know, they're pleased, they're not pleased, but they're willing to go along with raising the price from $50 per 1,000 cubic meters up to $230, but not overnight. You know, give us time to adjust to this. And Moscow is continuing, by the way, to sell gas at $50 per 1,000 cubic meters to countries that suck up to Moscow, who have autocrats running them, like Belarus, where the attempt to flip the election back when it got stolen didn't work. And Moldova, for example, they're all paying $50. So here, this is really what's going on here. I find it just fascinating. It's just fascinating. Anyways, just so you know, as we say, speaking of voting machines, Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, an update on voting machines there in New Mexico, Roy?
Good New Year.
Hey, Happy New Year to you too, Roy.
Elections in '06, investigations in '07.
There you go.
I mentioned a week or so ago that the action folks here in New Mexico had filed for a temporary restraining order to stop the county clerks from ordering the touchscreen machines. It has been issued.
Wow, that's great. Congratulations.
Now, that's the good news. That's the good news. The bad news is there was absolutely no discussion about it in the media. It was in the middle of a really screwed-up story that has showed up in the afternoon Albuquerque paper on Saturday.
So it's not being covered for all practical purposes.
It's not being covered at all. In fact, I was just typing a letter to the reporter who had written the story. The county clerk in Bernalillo County flat lied to him in so many ways, and he wrote the story on Friday and didn't get quotes from any of the voter activists.
Well, I hope you're contacting your local newspaper's editors and saying, hey, what's the deal?
Write the article as we speak.
Yeah, well, I would call them as well. I would just call them up. Hey, you know, person to person, what's going on here?
Well, nobody's around, but I mean,
yeah.
I'm documenting. I'll be talking to him.
Yeah. Oh, good on you, Roy. Keep on it, Roy and Rio Rancho.
There.
There you go. We got to take this country back. You're right. Absolutely. Thank you so much. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, yes, welcome back, friends. The place where we dare to ask the question, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't believe so. Do not think so. Not on this planet. No siree, Bob. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program, 9 minutes before the hour. Yes. Islamic fundamentalist Mohammed Atta, apparently, there's some reports here, visited, you know, we know about his trips to Vegas, right? Him and a couple of the other hijackers. These are the guys who flew the airplanes into the World Trade Center in 9/11, or at least so the story goes. Apparently, he made a visit to a cruise ship's, the Sun Cruise Line, unlicensed gambling boats plying the waters off the Florida coast before 9/11. And we don't know what he did there. These are, you know, this is a cash business. But what we do know is that the boats were owned by Jack Abramoff. Mohammed Atta. Hanging out on Jack Abramoff's cruise ship. Go figure. I mean, it just gets stranger and stranger and stranger. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Steve in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling as part of my celebrating my 21st birthday.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you. I'm calling for a couple reasons. One of them is a thing that happened at a Walmart in Hawaii. There was a mother there that bought an iPod for her son. And when they unwrapped it, instead of the iPod, there was a shrink wrap piece of raw meat.
That's interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, what does that have to do with anything, Steve?
Nothing, but nothing quite except that it's Walmart, and go figure, because they're evil.
I see. My guess is it wasn't Walmart, that somewhere along the line somebody pulled a switch, but I doubt it was the company.
However, here is something that I found that is, as you know, I'm the resident otaku, or computer nerd, on the chat room.
Mm-hmm.
And I've called a couple times about intellectual property laws.
Yeah, and the RIAA.
Yes, they are bullying witnesses into perjury.
Hmm.
So I found the news article on Slashdot, and it's backed up on Ars Technica, which is a very respected technology news website.
Yep, and Steve, let me just, because this gets technical and it gets long, and we don't have time for either right now, but let me just suggest to folks that if they want to learn more about this, and it is a fascinating topic, that they can either drop into the chat room where you're posting these links, or they can go to our message boards where I believe you've posted these links, right?
Yeah, I will make a point to post them again.
Okay.
And the other thing I wanted to quick mention is that I understand that Diebold has been nearly falling apart.
Yeah. Yeah, at least their voting machine division. Yeah, they're having some really serious problems. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Brian in New Hampshire. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. The alleged Medicare benefit, quote-unquote, officially kicked in just yesterday, January 1st, 2006.
Right.
Yes, and you read December 31st column in the Boston Globe by Bob Kuttner that dollars to donuts, Bush's drug benefit is no bargain.
Mm-hmm.
It's talking about my retired parents. They can't go through this kind of complicated.
I know. It's welcome to the wonderful world of insurance companies.
Oh, God.
And now we see, by the way, why the AARP was in support of this thing, because the AARP has their own plan that they're going to make a pile of money on. So.
And first of all, Mr. Kuttner, you just were to get right to brass tacks to not to salvage this plan, but first he says to get rid of the costly, crazy quilt of private programs and bring the Medicare, quote-unquote, drug program back into public Medicare and Medicaid, too.
Yeah.
But Medicaid people are under that now, under the Medicare drug benefit alleged program. But they're also saying that Medicare must be given the right to negotiate bulk discounts from these drug companies the way that...
Oh, absolutely. Does. I mean, you know, make it very straightforward. It's very simple. And, Brian, thank you. You raise a great point. It's very simple. You do it the way a lot of other countries do. The government negotiates the price. They go to the pharmaceutical company and say, okay, we're going to buy a billion, penicillin pills this year. What's your price on them? It's certainly a lot lower than on five of them. And they negotiate the super wholesale price. And then but they're distributed through local retail pharmacies. You don't want the local retail pharmacies to go out of business. You don't want to harm them. So you allow them to have some small amount of markup, some appropriate markup, so that they can, do whatever their normal markup is. But, take the middlemen out of it and take and replace them with a government negotiator, and boom, you've got drugs at, one-fifth the price that they're selling for, one-tenth. I mean, in some cases, one-fortieth the price. If you look at Canadian prices versus U.S. prices, and what's the difference? The Canadian government simply bulk negotiates, and then they sell them to pharmacies, and pharmacies mark them up. They make a profit on them, and so, how do you think these pharmacies stay in business? Lee in Redmond, Washington. Hey, Lee, welcome to the program.
Hi, and thank you for being you. You saved my sanity.
Well, thank you. I'm having fun. We have about a minute before we got to wrap up this hour, Lee. What's on your mind?
I'm calling about the first episode with the Ayn Rand discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
One of the things I notice is missing from these discussions always is that she also made a point that government properly needs to be building roads, defending from enemies both within and without, and taking care of those who cannot take care of themselves.
Now, I never got the taking care of those who can't take care of themselves part of Ayn Rand's writings.
Well, about 35 years ago, I read everything I could get my hands on of hers.
Uh-huh.
And it was in there.
Huh. Interesting.
And
It's been about that long since I read Atlas Shrugged, and that's the
Well,
I just don't remember it. I just remember who is John Galt,
Yeah. Well, it was a point that is lost on today's Republicans.
Yeah. Well said, Lee. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you for setting
the record straight. It's a point that's lost. And they talk about morality and family values, but they want to limit the entire scope. I mean, this whole huge world of morality to guns, gays, and whether or not Christmas has been hijacked. Give me a break. We have in America a historic and long tradition of being a moral people who take care of ourselves and our elders and our youngest and all of the most vulnerable, and we should continue to.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
As in every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, my friends. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, however you spell it, we'll get you there and just click the live chat link and come on in and say hi. Alec Dubrow is with us. Alec is with the International, he's actually the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org. And Alec, welcome to the program.
And I'm live too, so there you are.
There you go. Happy New Year, Alec.
And unto you, Tom, and all the listeners.
Thank you very much. What's on your list for today?
Well, I just thought I had taken a look backwards at what had happened last year. This is my chance to say what I think may help labor. A couple of goals, general goals, that I think labor should be shooting for in the year to come.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one that occurred to me, and the problem I run into out there a lot, is that labor does not have a visibility, and people are really not familiar with what unions actually do. And I ran across this. I had to go to a doctor a few weeks ago, one I'd never been to before. Young guy, about 30. He'd never heard of the AFL-CIO.
Seriously?
Lives in Washington. You know, a lot of people say I'm confused about what the AFL-CIO actually does. Never heard of it.
This is a guy who made it through medical school. He went
right.
to college. He never heard of the AFL-CIO.
That's correct.
This so illustrates my point that when I was growing up, there were newspapers that had labor sections, and there were newspapers that had business sections, and some newspapers had both. And I would say basically since about the mid-'80s, since the Reagan Revolution and all the M&A merger and all that mania and everything is all, you know, the business. And, in fact, it's interesting. You look at the studies that were done of who children's heroes were, and prior to the mid-'80s, their heroes, you know, who do you want to be like when you grow up? It was almost always George Washington, Abe Lincoln, you know, people who served the public.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, I want to be like Bill Gates. And you know, we have lost our connection to what made America great, which was public service and labor.
I couldn't agree with you more. And unfortunately, many people gain their knowledge of the country through drama, and particularly drama on television. So I thought, well, isn't it time for a show about a union? There, last I looked, there's what, about 2,000 cop shows, 1,000 lawyer shows, and 500 doctor shows,
yeah.
Maybe a couple of teacher shows, but not one union.
Well, and there have been big business shows. I mean,
there have been.
A number of them, in fact, over the years.
Right. Now, here's
all the way back to, you know, who shot JR. I mean, it's,
exactly. People like them even when they hate the figures in them.
Yeah, and you look at, you know, the Trump reality show. It's all about business.
Yeah, well, that's a peculiar notion of reality, if you ask me. But there it is, nevertheless. You know, 140,000 people actually work for labor unions in this country. This is not insignificant. And all the work, much of the work we do is laden with drama. I mean, if Hollywood wants to, throw in some sex and violence. You know, we don't have as much organized crime as there was, but maybe a little.
We could find some under some rug in southern Florida.
There is some, I'm
prop
sure.
It up there.
you want to get a soprano in here? Go ahead. But seriously.
Yeah,
you know,
really, even the mob has their own show.
That's right. That's right. And how many people work for them? Not too many. You know, there's conflict in human drama. people's daily lives are affected by labor, even if they're not in unions. So I say, you know, there have been a few movies, but they're all excessively earnest. So how about at Hollywood? How about a sitcom? It's all there. Call me. I'm waiting.
There you go. You really need to be pitching this to somebody, somebody who could do something with it. I mean, there are those folks out there, you know, who are labor friendly, the Rob Reiners of the world.
Sure. You know, I mean, let's pitch a few. The second one is in that vein, but really, how about cultivating some more interesting labor spokespeople? And, you know, let's face it, when it comes to amusing labor spokespeople, I'm it. And I'm not even a professionally trained broadcast kind of guy. And moreover, I'm white and middle-aged. And
so you think we should, like, hire Al Sharpton or Traficant? Or do you, I mean, which is kind of going back to the days of Jimmy Hoffa. I'm not sure what you mean by, you know, by
sports people. Well, it's like this. I've been to a number of labor media trainings where they try to train people in labor to deal with the media.
Right.
And we've never taken it to the level of where we want to cultivate people like you or Stephanie Miller or Franken or something like that.
Yeah.
Every time they get out.
How to be outrageous.
That's right. Or at least amusing. Yeah. You know, it's all polemic and hurt feelings. You know, it shouldn't be this way or this is the way it should be. But the truth is, you know, people respond to personalities as well as to issues.
Yeah.
And it's really important that people become, A, familiar with some spokespeople, and, B, that they're engaged with them.
Well, you know, it occurs to me that labor has this to some extent in several of your unions. The one guy who comes to mind, Andy Stern.
Andy's good. Yeah.
He's an articulate firebrand. The problem is, the media doesn't cover what's going on in labor. I mean, Andy could stand on a street corner in Washington D.C. and you know, be shouting with a bullhorn, and they wouldn't cover it.
Well,
in fact, he probably has.
That's what I say. We have to be craftier, more conniving. You know, I'm not a media genius. I'm just a coordinator.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how to get the time on there.
Yeah.
But part of it is the personalities, and part of it is what we're offering.
Yeah, and you know, the guy who's the head of the Transit Workers Union there in New York City. What's his name?
Roger Toussaint?
Yeah, Toussaint.
He was good.
Here's another, you know, charismatic guy, you know. Get him out there. Get him out there more.
Indeed. But we need some younger people of color, you know. Get out and talk to people in person and on the air. I mean,
so what else is on your list?
Well, let's see. How about something a little more serious than this? My idea is to noisily expand the living wage campaigns to state and national level.
It seems to me that, and in fact, there was a piece about this in the New York Times, as I recall, today or yesterday, that really the minimum wage campaigns have been entirely in the states. Washington State, for example, just raised their minimum wage by about 20, 30 cents, something like that, you know, at the beginning of the year. Oregon's is $7.25 an hour,
that's,
I believe,
right.
It doesn't have an inflation adjuster in it. It's just there. But it's the states that are picking up this banner. I mean, if the minimum wage, if the historic high of the minimum wage was maintained into today and adjusted for inflation, it'd be in the neighborhood of $8, wouldn't it?
Yeah, something like that, maybe even above. I'm not sure. But
yeah.
Certainly
so,
wouldn't be at $5.15.
Right.
Did you see today's Times, by the way? There was an article in it on states take lead to push to raise the minimum wage.
Yeah, that's my point.
And there was a great quote from the legislative director of the AFL-CIO, Bill Samuel. He said it. On this issue, the public is way ahead of Washington. They see this as a matter of basic fairness, the underpinning of basic labor law, a floor under wages, so we're not competing with Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people do understand this issue. And, you know, it's just deadlocked at the federal level because of Republican control of the committees and the Congress. And the president would never sign such a thing. But you're right. You know, the states have been doing it. But I'm talking about living wage, moving beyond minimum. Minimum, you know, even $8 an hour is not going to get people at a decent standard of living.
Yeah.
And you know, unless you're perfectly comfortable with creating a permanent underclass or expanding the number of immigrant sweatshop industries, you need to raise wages and impose.
Well, the Republicans are perfectly comfortable with that. That's the problem.
Yeah, it is.
And the vast majority of Americans don't realize that the primary Republican agenda is an economic agenda, that they're out there talking about gay marriage in order to distract people from the fact that it's an economic agenda. It's about jobs and the quality of those jobs at the end of the day. And so many different things feed into this, whether it's illegal immigration or whether it's, the ability to join a union easily or form a union easily. The list goes on and on and on of the things that ultimately come back to economics should we have cheap stuff in Walmart? Well, aren't you worried about that? You know, and tariffs and trade organizations, and it all boils down to cheap labor over and over again.
You're absolutely right. Let's just keep pointing it out. Maybe people will awaken to it at some point.
Eventually. Alec DeBrow, the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA, online.org, the website. Alec, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Good talking with you. Happy New Year. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
People say I'm crazy, doing what I'm doing. Well, they give me all kinds of warnings to save me from ruin.
And welcome back to the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Approximately 45 million Americans, 15.6% of the population, were without health insurance coverage in 2003, the last year for which we have statistics. That was 1.4 million more than 2002, by the way. It's been going up. 45 million Americans. Americans. And hospitals now, you show up without insurance. I mean, yeah, if you're in a car accident, they've got to take you in. But if you show up and say, I got this lump on my arm, doesn't that look like skin cancer? They can just say, sorry. 82 million people. One third of the population below the age of 65. 82 million people spent a portion of either the year 2002 or 2003 without health coverage. The percentage of people with employment-based health insurance dropped from 70% in 1987 to 61% in 2004, and this reveals the fatal flaw in our system, and frankly, the hope for change in this system, and that is that we have an employer-based health care system in the United States. Now, back in the 1940s, back in the 30s and the 40s, when there were two very different dynamics at work. One was healthcare was not particularly expensive. It was not high tech. Doctors were not millionaires. Bill Frist's father was not a billionaire. People were not making millions and billions in the healthcare industry. In fact, by and large, the healthcare industry was a non-profit industry. Doctors did okay, but at most hospitals across the country, probably all of them in the 1940s certainly, were nonprofit organizations, many of them run by local counties or municipalities or by the Catholic Church or others. I mean, the Mormons ran one. The Seventh-day Adventists have several hospitals. So, number one, healthcare wasn't all that expensive. And number two, businesses wanted to hang on to their employees for the long haul. In fact, there was this whole thing about how can we keep somebody at this job, at this place for 30 years, because we know that the cost of retraining an employee is high. The cost of turnover is high. The cost of turnover is high both to our society and to us as a business. What can we do to keep people at the job? And what came out of this was the idea of pensions. We guarantee if you work here for 20 or 30 years that we will pay you a certain amount for the rest of your life. And health care. We will take, you know, we'll provide you with your health care. Because they wanted to keep employees. Well, now we have a situation where, A, health care costs have exploded through the roof because we've privatized the health care system starting in the 1980s by and large. You know, Reagan and deregulation. And some of it actually started under Jimmy Carter but by and large, Ronald Reagan, with the whole deregulation thing, and then Bush Sr., and then Clinton, and then Bush Jr. I mean, this has been a 30-year process, which has allowed people like Bill Frist's father to go from being merely wealthy to being one of the 100 wealthiest men in America, a multi-billionaire. So we've privatized health. We've taken health care out of the not-for-profit sector and put it into the for-profit sector. We've turned it into an industry. One of the biggest industries in the United States, by the way, along with food. Huge. Profitable, number one. And number two, businesses, because we no longer have tariff rules that say, you know, pretty much, you're going to have to manufacture this in the United States if you want to sell it in the United States. Now, they don't say that, but they worked that way. You know, you're welcome to manufacture stuff in China, but the tax you're going to pay on it when you import it into the United States is going to be so high, it's going to cost the same as if you made it here, so you might as well make it here. And when people are making things here, then, you know, they want to have a stable workforce. And there's a third element here that has been falling apart since the Reagan era. And this one really started aggressively falling apart during the Reagan era. And that was the idea of small and medium-sized businesses owned by people who lived in the communities where they employed the people who worked for them. And so they wanted to be seen as, not as Scrooge and Marley's, but they wanted to be seen as responsible members of the community. And so they provided health care, they provided pensions, they lived in their community, they took out a good salary, maybe 30, 40 times what everybody else is making, but not 400 times. Because they were part of the community. And all of that got blown out the window when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and all of these small and medium-sized businesses, these mom-and-pop shops, and even, for, you know, multi-million business, dollar businesses with, you know, 30, 50, 100 employees, but locally owned, started being bought up by giant conglomerates who had no responsibility to anybody. And you get Chainsaw Al Dunlap, for example, who's running around, you know, and companies bringing him in, and he'll whack 10,000 workers just like that tomorrow morning and take his millions of dollars and hum his merry tune. And the whole thing has changed ever since Reagan changed the dynamic in America, and it's changed for the worse. And health care is the symptom of it. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome, my friends. We want democracy now. We want the whole thing. Welcome back to the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Program, 25 minutes before the hour. Mark Carlin is with us from BuzzFlash.com and Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com for our best of the rest of the news segment, looking over what's been going on in the previous week, what's coming up in the next week. Hey, Mark Carlin with BuzzFlash.com. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Happy New Year.
Well, thank you, and the same to you. And also to you, Brad Friedman, with BradBlog.com.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Happy New Year to you and Louise both.
Thank you. Thank you. Mark Carlin, I'm wondering, what are the biggest stories on BuzzFlash right now?
I think the biggest story, and I'm certain you've covered it, Tom, is this revelation, another whistleblowing revelation of Bush lying and criminality, in this case that there was NSA wiretapping. The latest development this weekend was in the New York Times that when John Ashcroft was in the hospital and James Comey, who also happens to oversee the Fitzgerald, or had overseen the Fitzgerald investigation before Comey resigned, he was acting attorney general for the time that Ashcroft was in the hospital, and he said that the NSA wiretapping conducted by the White House without going through the FISA court was illegal, and he said it can't continue. So Andrew Card and the White House consigliere, Gonzalez, now the attorney general, went to Ashcroft, who was still in the hospital, to get his approval to continue with the program. So here was proof that the acting attorney general at the time said that this was an illegal activity.
And how do you think this is going to play out, Mark?
It all comes down in today's world, as we've discussed many a time, Tom, to how the media is used by the Democrats and the Republicans. Mm-hmm. What happens in these cases is Bush keeps saying a lie over and over again, and enough of the public believes it that the issue goes away. Mm-hmm. The lie now is that this gave comfort to the enemy. He's having Gonzalez.
By outing the story.
Yeah, Gonzalez was a co-conspirator in the criminal act of implementing illegally the NSA wiretaps, is now in charge of investigating who leaked, in essence, was a witness to the crime. So what we're getting now is the crime doesn't matter, but the person who is the witness to the crime and reports it is now culpable.
That's what boggles my mind.
The Bush administration. I just want to quickly add one more thing.
Sure.
To add crime to crime, Bush is claiming this hurt national security. The reality is that everyone knew, including Al-Qaeda, potential terrorists, that the FISA court had the ability to authorize wiretaps. The only difference is that Bush did them illegally. There was nothing revealed here that was unknown to Al-Qaeda. The only difference is that Bush did it illegally. Al-Qaeda knew they could be wiretapped because the FISA court had that authority. So there was absolutely no compromise in national security here, and that's just the lie for Bush to pull the same old 9/11 fear tactic against the American public. Unfortunately, unless the Democrats push back, and they have a tendency to shout for a day or two and then pull back, Bush's lie will prevail, I think.
Well, it's the problem is they don't have subpoena power. They don't have the ability to call a committee hearing and investigate something with the power of a subpoena and with the power of swearing somebody under oath, because the Republicans hold both the House and the Senate, and they won't authorize any kind of an investigation.
Well, that is true, and it's also become so brazen, and we've said this many times in Buzzflash, that you have a banality of evil here. Bush does things that are so bold and audacious in defying the Constitution, defying the law, breaking the law, and lying, that on a logical basis, unless you do have him in a court of law or in an impeachment process, an American looks at what he says and looks at what someone says about him and says, well, no one would do anything as outrageous as he's doing and lie about it.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And so you become someone who's marginalized by claiming, or I do, or Buzzflash or Brad, that this man has broken the law and is now lying about the national security issue.
Imagine if Nixon had come out and said, those guys, Woodward and Bernstein, they have compromised national security by exposing this break-in at the Watergate. We are going to get to the bottom of this. The Justice Department is going to investigate these guys. We're going to find out who this deep throat guy is, and we're going to put him in jail.
And on top of it, what's really important to remember here as a secondary point is the person in charge, quote-unquote, of that investigation of the leaker. They didn't seem to care in the White House at all, and Bush still doesn't care who leaked a CIA operative's name and rendered her inoperable tracking weapons of mass destruction. But the person now in charge of the so-called investigation of the leaker of Bush's illegal activity is Gonzalez, who was a party to the illegal activity.
Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, what's the biggest story? In addition to a website there, you also do a radio show. What's the biggest story you're covering, Brad?
Oh, hello, did I lose you?
Yeah, Brad, you still there?
Hello.
Yeah.
Oh, I lost you there. What was the question?
I said you, in addition to having a blog there, you also have a radio program. I'm wondering what the biggest story that you that's on your plate right now.
Well, as we were coming to the end of the year, as you know, the big Help America Vote Act deadline for states and counties to choose their new election upgrades was upon us, and so the last few weeks has been just an unbelievable roller coaster as states and counties were scrambling to figure out this mess. And what we've determined here at the end of the year, as I'm sure you know, this hack of Diebold voting machines down in Leon County has revealed some pretty extraordinary things. In fact, that there is a type of code that we'll call interpreted code that is banned by the Help America Vote Act 2002 guidelines, and in fact has been discovered in Diebold machines. And now there is an ongoing effort to contact the Election Assistance Commission and the Independent Testing Authority. That's the federal groups that are responsible for certifying these machines at the federal level. There is an effort now to say, hey, look, you have certified these machines that have this banned code. It is time to withdraw certification from any machines, Diebold or otherwise, that has this type of code. At the end of the year, California Secretary of State sent back these Diebold machines to the feds to have them take a look at this. And right now, VoteTrustUSA.org and VelvetRevolution.us, which is a group that I've co-founded, is spearheading an effort to contact these federal authorities and say, look, it's time to withdraw certification from all of these machines, which have now been proved to be hackable. So I'd recommend all your listeners stop by VelvetRevolution.us and fill out that that petition right away. Other than that, there's been a lot of attention on these Diebold machines, as you know, but now attention is beginning to turn to another voting machine company, in fact, bigger than Diebold, ES&S.
The one Chuck Hagel used to be the president of.
I'm sorry?
The one that Senator Chuck Hagel used to be the president of.
That's exactly right, and they worked very well in his favor, apparently, when he ran for a senator out there
right.
in Nebraska.
Yeah.
But now, yeah, it turns out that out here in California, in the last special elections we had in November, there was all kinds of problems with these ES&S machines, and the state of California sent a letter to ES&S threatening them with decertification as well. Diebold machines, certain Diebold machines have already been decertified out here. But what is interesting, they sent them this letter. They had on videotape people trying to vote and the votes flipping from one candidate to another. People were not able to confirm their choices on these touchscreen machines. So they sent this letter threatening to decertify, but they didn't reveal this letter to anybody. And we didn't find out about it for 5 weeks. While they were deciding, you know, what machines they were going to choose by the HAVA deadline at the end of the year, until an AP reporter, of all people, got a hold of the letter and reported on it. And now folks are just furious out here wondering why the heck the voters weren't informed about this problem. We have got a mess. Tom.
But there's a really, there's even a larger issue than that, Brad Friedman, and that of bradblog.com, and that is that somewhere along the way, our vote got privatized. I mean, from 1787 until up until the last 5, 6, 7 years thereabouts, our voting was handled by our government in a transparent fashion. You could volunteer, you could oversee the counting of the vote. Now it's been privatized. We have private corporations handling our votes. This is absolutely nuts. And Mark Carlin, I'm wondering at BuzzFlash.com if the privatization of the vote is a meme that you see grabbing any traction in the coming year.
Well, we deeply admire Brad, and there are many others. There's a whole community that's been watching this. But unfortunately, this is the type of issue, because the Democrats have not championed this, except for a few in the House, John Conyers among them. It hasn't gotten national traction. I think this is one of those things that people just don't buy. They don't realize the gravity of this. It's one of those things, again, where they just have faith that in general voting goes pretty well. And so it's hard for them to understand, as you said, the key thing here, which was the key thing in the North Carolina case, which is, in through all these cases, that you essentially have companies that have copyright and trademark rights to the software they're counting that they will not divulge to the government. So they have, in essence, the absolute right to determine the final count without anyone really knowing how they're doing that.
Yeah, this is just
a black
absolutely
box
wrong.
Of voting that, as you said, the voter and
yeah,
the government
it's wrong and it's out of control. Mark Carlin, BuzzFlash.com, Brad Friedman, BradBlog.com. Thanks a lot, guys.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Let's get it started. Ha! Let's get it started. Yeah. Let's get it started. Ha! Let's get it started. Yeah. Let's get it started. Ha! Let's
and
get it started.
Welcome back, my friends. Yes, let's get it started. The radio support group out by and for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Program, 9 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, BJ in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Happy New Year's.
Happy New Year to you. I called the other day about Bush and how he's going to get in trouble from not only the leak investigation, but everything else. And I think I read that same New York column that your guest was just talking about on Sunday, and I'm guessing that Comey's the leak. And I think that they know that. I think the administration knows that, and they're going to go after him hard. But I don't think they knew that this was going to come out in the paper about him denying to approve the wiretaps.
Right, refusing to approve the wiretaps, and
yeah.
Then ultimately they're having to go to Ashcroft. So
yeah.
What's... I mean, as a result of this, what happens? I mean, my guess of what's going to happen here on this thing is that they're going to use the, quote, investigation, end quote, as a way to just bury this thing. Gonzalez is going to be investigating this, and, you know, it's going to be a joke. And they're not going to make the Fitzgerald mistake again and get a real investigator. It's going to be a Justice Department investigation. And it's going to get swept under the rug, and Bush is going to go on. And the only thing... Oddly, ironically, weirdly enough, the only thing that I think that might actually pull this thing out is if Republicans, particularly in the United States Senate, stand up and start speaking out. And that's why, for example, you know, I have a Republican senator here in Oregon, Senator Smith, who I intend to contact and say, Senator Smith, you know, do something about this. You've got a president who is breaking the law, and he needs to be investigated by Republicans.
Yeah. Well, Arlen Specter is going to have – they're going to have congressional hearings on it as soon as they come back in, and deputy is going to be one of the first ones. Comey will be one of the first ones to bring in now, and I think they're going to try to pin it on him that he's leaking information. Like you just said, it was illegal to leak it, but it didn't affect because Al-Qaeda knew that we were wiretapping.
Bush is trying. He really clearly makes it so clear that he thinks that the average American has an IQ of about 65. I mean,
yeah.
He comes out and he says, now the terrorists know that we might be wiretapping them. Like, you know, like up until now, they thought, gee, I wonder if those guys have the ability to wiretap me.
And I'll be honest, I'm really an independent. I voted for Bush the first time, second time after. I felt like he did exactly what you just said. He thinks that we're idiots. And there's too much lying and everything like that, and now this cover-up, and they're going to try to cover it up, and it's not going to work. It's just like the Republicans always say that now they have the new media out there in the blogosphere, and that's what's helping them. Well, it's going two ways on this. This is going to come out, and
yeah.
There's no way. As much as he tries to cover it up, and the thing is, he's dumb enough to try to cover it up, that it's going to build up on him, and by the time we hit 2008, that's why you're going to have a new Democratic president, and by end of this year, I think we're going to have a Democratic House and Senate.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, BJ, let's just hope that that's the case. Thanks a lot for the call, and Happy New Year to you. May this year bring all your fondest wishes, and that to all of my listeners. May this be an extraordinary, wonderful, and blessed year. Fascinating article in the San Francisco Chronicle this last week. I started out about quarter after the hour on this third hour of the program talking about healthcare systems and the healthcare crisis in the United States. And this article by Tom O'Brien, Two Women, Two Cancers, Two Healthcare Systems, basically profiles a In fact, he starts it out. He says, after a long time away, you see with new eyes. I moved back to the United States with my Canadian wife and two small boys after 15 years in Toronto and Ottawa. And so here's a guy who's seen both sides of it. And he talks about an American colleague of his, a woman that he knew in the United States who was struck in March with cancer, and a Canadian woman that he knew, friends, these are both friends of his family, this reporter, this guy, Tom O'Brien, who wrote this for the San Francisco Chronicle, Canadian woman who also got cancer. And the Canadian was able to take sick leave and was able to fight her cancer. And that's what she did. She took on the cancer. He says, Kathleen, back in Canada, was gripped by uterine cancer, which had spread to her intestines. While she was locked in a life-and-death battle for 18 months, she didn't have to worry about losing her health care and choosing which bills to pay. Canadian Medicare covers everyone for everything in hospitals and doctors' offices, including even some elective procedures. That means no health care caused bankruptcies, no fights with insurers, no insurance-driven financial worries. So she could focus her energy on fighting her cancer, which she did. On the other hand, his friend Susan in the United States, her primary battle wasn't with the cancer, it was with the health insurance company. The health insurance company was saying, well, we won't pay for that, and we're not sure we'll pay for this, and you have to document that. And her employer, who's saying, well, now you've used up your normal period of sick days and vacation days, and so we're no longer going to pay for your health insurance, so you're going to have to pick it up yourself, but we're no longer going to pay you either. And so where is she going to get the money to pay for the health insurance? And then even when she does pay for the health insurance, the health insurance company is saying, well, we're not sure we're going to pay for this bill, and we're not, and that treatment, I'm not sure we're going to cover that treatment. And so here's the American who is, during the time that she's also fighting her cancer, spending more of her time actually fighting her insurance company. This is a tragic and destructive system. We are the only country in the industrialized world that has a for-profit healthcare system that produces multi-billionaires like Bill Frist's father. The only country in the industrialized world. And this is the result of it. And hopefully we will see a change, a significant and rapid change in this in the United States, by and large, because it's really starting to hurt business interests in this country. Businesses are no longer competitive because we have this business-funded health insurance. So it's no longer the tool the business once was able to use to keep employees. Thanks for being with us today, my friends. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.